You're listening to the COVID-19 Update, a podcast from the CSIS Global Health Policy Center focused on the science and policy implications of the outbreak. I'm Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm joined by my colleague, Steve Morrison, to discuss the latest on COVID-19.
I'm delighted today to be joined by a close friend and colleague, Yanzhong Wang. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
Yanzhong is a professor at Seton Hall University's School of Diplomacy and International Relations. He's also the Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And much to our benefit, he co-chairs with Scott Kennedy a working group on China and U.S.-China relations as part of our CSIS Commission on Strengthening America's Health Security. We're very grateful that you could come in and be with us today, and very grateful for all the great work you've contributed to our cause here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So we're here today to talk about zero COVID in China, the dynamic zero COVID approach of the Chinese. You've been prolific at tracking things, commenting, writing on this crisis as it has morphed into bigger and bigger proportions and bigger uncertainties. Why don't we start with just where are we right now in terms of the outbreaks in China?
Well, as we all know, what the Chinese facing the largest crisis since the Wuhan outbreak, right? The Shanghai lockdown, right? We are seeing the continually high daily count of cases, right? The 20,000 cases each day. But it is also having its impact felt in the supply chain, not just in China, but also now affecting the global supply chain. That is going to also affect China's ability to achieve the 5.5% annual economic growth rate for 2022. And in the meantime, people's discontent, dissatisfaction are simmering on the rise. You know, they also they started to question the wisdom of the zero COVID. You know, some of the people, according to Cai Xing, the most recent report, 23 Chinese cities have imposed four lockdown measures that affects directly 30 million people. But according to a Japanese source, you know, there's at least 44 cities have imposed four or partial lockdown measures that affect close maybe 200 million people. You know, that does not include those cities that are not reporting cases, but also imposed this mass PCR testing, or even the measures that restrict people's movements. You know, so the entire country is sort of as I would say, a large number of isolated islands, you know, if you want to use that metaphor to describe what China is experiencing now.
Well, the Nomura, the Japanese bank, they cited a figure last week of 373 million people, 25% of China's population, under either partial or full lockdown. That's an extraordinary number. And they said it was 40% of the GDP, which means that almost half of the national economy is in some form of disruption. It was interesting, too, that the German Chamber of Commerce in China sent a letter to the government saying, look, these lockdowns are disrupting 50% of their supply chain, severely disrupting their supply chain, and which means that it is already very much globalized, right, in terms of having impact on global supply chains, having inflationary impacts, I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, remind me what the Shanghai public health official said, that Shanghai is the world's Shanghai, right? So what is happening in Shanghai is having its impact felt, you know, in other parts of the world now. I just imagine this country was, according to one source, not verified, you know, that three-quarters of the volume of freight in the supply chain now has been affected because you have all the truck drivers being stuck on the highway, not moving an inch. Many of these factories suspend operation. Shanghai is certainly as the financial, the business hub of China, but they have also many multinational firms, but they're doing business with other countries. Right? So, it's not only going to affect the China's economy, it's going to affect the global supply chain. Soon we're going to face that the impact, on what kind of goods we're going to be able to buy, right? Or we're not going to be able to buy. And that could also, I think, affect the global inflation level.
People have pointed out that the Chinese population has a acute vulnerability, right? Particularly among the elderly, that there's poor vaccination levels. Their vulnerability is also the fact that the vaccines have proven to be not very good in terms of protections. They're waning immunity there. They don't have, in terms of getting a third dose of an mRNA, there was a deal that in the works with Fosun and with BioNTech, but that has not been approved. There seems to be a kind of a nationalist barrier to finding a quick solution on getting a third dose of an mRNA. They don't have antivirals in any volume as well. They're really stuck in wanting to adhere, it seems to me, to adhere and double down on the strict measures of lockdown and mass testing. They don't seem to be compromising much. You might say a bit about how they're trying to be around the edges, trying to soften some of these controls because people have been so upset by this. And there's open voices of opposition, unlike what we've seen in a long time. Say a bit about that, about why so many asymptomatic cases? How do we explain that?
Well, speaking of the vaccination, right, is this the zero COVID, actually, in a way, right, encouraged, right, that those elderly people not to get vaccinated because they feel like we're safe here already. We're shielded, right, from the virus. Why bother to get vaccinated? In the meantime, right, the implementation of the strategy means mobilization of the health personnel to conduct the mass PCR testing, to implement the quarantine measures. So you don't have many people left to do others to promote those vaccines, right? So it was not until November last year they started to promote the vaccination among the elderly. But, strictly speaking, it is not until recently they started to get serious.
Why have they been so reluctant to close that gap? I mean, this is a highly authoritarian and dictatorial regime. Why not simply lay down the order?
Well, yeah, I was baffled by the same question, right? If you can, make, this quarantining of those close contacts or even sub-close contacts mandatory, if you can make, right, the PCR testing mandatory, why can't you make the administration of the elderly mandatory, right? So that is something that, have been puzzled me all the time, but, I think my explanation is that it reveals this tension between zero COVID and a mitigation-based approach that prioritizes the elderly. Because zero COVID really just cares about the number of infections. They don't care why who get the infected. So the prioritizing by the elderly, right, that means essentially a shift of the strategy to a mitigation-based approach, which they want still reluctant to pursue. But in the meantime, right, there's some other reasons, like the effectiveness of the vaccines. Right? Many of the elderly do not want to get vaccinated because they're concerned about the adverse effects of the Chinese vaccines.
Well, the Washington Post yesterday published a lead editorial saying, look, there's a cover-up going on here in China. And we don't have much in the way of deaths reported. We can look at Hong Kong and get a pretty good idea of what may be happening in elderly facilities in China. Say a bit about that. How do we explain the extraordinarily low death rates?
Yeah, this is another puzzle, right, that we are seeing, right? In Hong Kong, right, they also pursued a sort of like quasi, zero COVID strategy. There's a large, right, unvaccinated elderly population, But in Hong Kong, you have the world's highest COVID death rate. But in Shanghai, so far, they only reported three cases. That was only reported, I believe, yesterday. And in actually, entire China over the past 14 to 15 months, if you count, the death in Shanghai is like about only five, you know, total deaths. That seems to be, to many people, very unlikely, especially considering that China, you have, but still, like 10% of the population not fully vaccinated, 52 million elderly who are not vaccinated, including half of them who are aged over 80. Right? In Shanghai, we have 4 million people. I believe, you know, many of them are elderly, unvaccinated, of the 26 million. Yeah. So, you know, if based on the mortality data elsewhere, right, you would expect the death toll would be larger than those reported, you know, by the government.
If we have, in reality, a significant death rate unfolding now in China, would the government be capable of bottling that up, of not disclosing, or is it going to be disclosed through various other means?
Well, I think if there's indeed a large number of deaths, right, I think sooner or later it has to be revealed, right? This is what happened in Wuhan, right? You know, initially there seems to be a cover-up on the death toll there. But you know, later they decided to readjust the mortality data and increased the death number by 50%. You know that decided, you know, this chaos by the uncoordinated efforts as a reason, right, for this underreporting problem. So if there's indeed a cover up, we would expect that sooner or later we're going to find out.
So as to the question of where is this heading, it seems to me, we've talked about this a little bit, it seems to me that China's now in a phase where there's multiple concurrent outbreaks in the country. Some may be moving in and out. We may see things stabilize in Shanghai. But for the foreseeable future, it looks like China's facing a continued crisis that's going to migrate into other parts of the country. Would you agree with that?
It is facing, right, these multiple concurrent outbreaks, but certainly, right, the Shanghai outbreak is the largest. And it looks like, you know, they want to end that crisis as soon as possible, right? So, you know, it seems very likely that by the end of this month, they're going to declare the end of the lockdown or lift the lockdown in Shanghai, right? Simply the rising social economic cost is just way too high. Where they want to end the crisis as soon as possible to basically return the life to certain normalcy. But in the meantime, as we know, right, given this huge immunity gap between China and the rest of the world, the more successful the zero COVID strategy is, you know, the more it means that you still have a large population that is shielded from the virus, but all because of the low efficacy rates of the Chinese vaccines having relatively low immunity level. So you still have this large vulnerable population to feed the virus, right? And in a way also provide the fertile ground for the spread of the virus. Right. So, you know, as long as China does continue that zero COVID approach, right, as long as you have this sustained immunity gap, you know, that means China has not reached the so-called herd immunity, you are going to see the crises continue to be coming, right? And this wave, you know, after wave of Omicron attack, you know, that is not going to end until, right, the virus has maybe affected at least like half of the population in the country.
On the government side, of course, what we're seeing is not, they're not turning a corner. They're doubling down on zero COVID, what they're calling the dynamic zero COVID approach. They're making a few adjustments around the margins, but fundamentally, it seems that for the time being, there is not going to be a shift of strategy towards a more targeted set of populations like the elderly or moving to living with this virus in some fashion as an endemic phenomenon versus this zero COVID approach. Would you agree with that?
It is true, right, that even what the government, is now concerned about this rapid rise in social economic costs, right? They have now started to introduce certain flexibility in implementing zero COVID strategy. It looks like, well, again, in Shanghai, they might redefine the narrative or this indication that they're giving up this practice of mass PCR testing to encourage instead by the antigen testing at home. That is hopefully what will sort of ease up those pressures by the local government officials now are facing and return some kind of normalcy in the city. But in the meantime, the central government has sent a very clear and loud signal. Zero COVID, will continue. And these local governments, should be held accountable for the COVID situation in their jurisdiction. Don't expect them to deviate from the central playbook by pursuing a more flexible approach. And that the situation is going to continue through the 420th Party Congress. That will be this fall. We don't know which month. It could be September, could be October or November. But if they are convinced the elderly has been adequately vaccinated, they have built up the capacity, deal with a surge of the cases, and more importantly, if the top leader himself changed his mentality on zero COVID, I think it would be time to see China started to relax the policy. But even that, I think don't expect China to open up anytime soon, because we are seeing, that it becomes even more difficult for foreigners to visit China now.
So what do you think the government's going to do in terms of getting mass production of mRNA? They have an option on the table to go with BioNTech, which is a German firm, right? Along with a Chinese production company, Fosun, based out of Shanghai. They've got that on the table, but their own mRNA options have not turned out well. What do you foresee they have to come to some solution of getting a third dose to their population that's not Sinovac or Sinopharm.
Well, currently, they're encouraging people to take the third dose through the sequential vaccination process. They're actually encouraging people to take the CanSino's vaccine and that Anhui Zhifei vaccine, which is not these two most popular vaccines China have been using. For the mRNA vaccines, they have approved the clinical trial of additional mRNA vaccines domestically made, even though that so far we haven't heard any significant progress being made on that front. So even though they have successfully developed its own mRNA vaccine, it takes time to mass produce the vaccine and to administer it on the population in the country. So don't expect that to happen in the next 6 months, I think.
One of the things that's quite striking about this is this is a human crisis, right? It's really a human crisis on a huge scale that could get much bigger and much worse. And yet the outside world has very little influence over what's happening. And you don't see the U.S. government stepping forward in any fashion, even to register compassion with those who are at serious risk of serious illness, if not death. We don't see much of a role by WHO in this. Of course, the relations with WHO very strained between China. And as I said earlier, there's an industry option. Industry has come forward with an option. So that's promising. Is this just something that the outside world really has no role to play in trying to come up with solutions or try to engage? Or is it just too far?
Great question, right? Six years ago, I published an article basically arguing that despite the murky, untransparent, authoritarian, policy making, the foreign factors, foreign influence can still penetrate the policy process, they shape even the public policy in China. We saw that in China's AIDS policy process, Steve, you've been involved in that, right? They have been accommodating, right, to the Geneva, so-called Geneva consensus, right? Right. Basically, right, abandon their own, right, this policy on AIDS prevention control.
And that required coming to grips with scandals, political scandals, right? I mean, 2 to 4 million Chinese died of HIV in the central provinces. Yeah. That was covered up, but then they came back and admitted.
Yeah, and admitted. And this, if you consider that, that it's a crisis management, it's the actual successful example, right, of crisis management. Because today, few people talk about the AIDS crisis in China because the situation is brought under control there. But then I think now the situation, especially after 2018, I think the situation is changing in a way that makes China less willing to accept, you know, not just the Chinese fund, the foreign funding, but also the foreign ideas, right? You might recall in the beginning stage of the outbreak, the Trump administration, right, offered to send epidemiologists to China. You know, they show no interest. And more recently, right, during the Ukraine crisis, the U.S. 6 times warned China, right, about the Russian invasion. They just didn't believe it. So I think, right, that you know, this lack of trust between China and the Western world is a big problem. But in the meantime, it also has something to do with, right, this rising self-confidence. You know, you might consider that a cocky pro attitude toward the outside world that also plays a role. You know, simply the relative success of China's pandemic control and the quote-unquote failure of the Western handling of the crises, right, that this performance gap is perceived by many Chinese as a, you know, example showing by the superiority of the Chinese political system. There's really not much Western countries can offer to China nowadays, right? I think the Western leverage in China's public policy process has been in decline significantly and rapidly. So that makes also U.S.-China cooperation, even on an issue we think is of utmost importance to global health security, that is this pandemic preparedness and planning, so difficult now.
You know, when you step back for a moment, Ukraine certainly has not made the situation any easier for the Chinese government and for President Xi. You look at how difficult his situation is. The EU-Chinese summit of 2.5 weeks ago, Borrell came on, the EU foreign affairs head, came out and said it was the dialogue of the deaf. He said the Chinese simply have no grasp of the magnitude of what's happening with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what that means for Europe. The mismanagement of the relationship with the United States, that's in terrible shape. Economic growth, 5.5% estimated levels, was already way too high. They're going to get nowhere near that number now. The uncontrolled transmission, it's setting China up for being a disruptor of global economy and new variants, right? And his third term, which is what is on the table for the Party Congress in the fall, and his control over the Politburo, those are on the table, right? It's a tough time to, I mean, and when you look at all of those predicaments that he faces, he doesn't have a lot of leeway for shaping his agenda right now. He's in a real box. And so doubling down on zero COVID when it's patently obvious that it's failing and that you're having multiple outbreaks and that it's terribly dangerous for this population that is acutely vulnerable. I still wonder, when does this reach a breaking point, or when? What more is it going to take for there to be some sort of reassessment?
Great question. I think, well, you are absolutely right. In this reactive, crisis-driven atmosphere, there is really not much, right, for the leaders, top decision makers, I mean, to maneuver, right, to have a second thought, for example, on whether it's wise to give up the zero COVID strategy, to, you know, reassess its approach, right, to the crisis in Ukraine. I mean, this foreign policy, and also by to have a new policy, right, on the Chinese economy. I think This all has to be settled after the 20th Party Congress, you know. But even after that, we talk about this policy innovation, right? Given that, the political power, this influential political resources are so centralized, right, in the top, it's these local initiatives, actually unlikely going to be undertaken in this, what I call the bandwagon polity, instead of, taking their own initiatives, local actors have strong incentives to jump onto President Xi's bandwagon, to show their loyalty, their support to Xi's favorite agenda. So ultimately, it all depends on President Xi's, himself, whether, when he's want to, to have a policy reassessment, to have a new policy in place, and to what extent he's allowing his subordinates, even his the fellow Politburo Standing Committee members to have, some policy innovation or flexibility, right? So this is all very constrained policy process.
Does the West have anything to offer at this moment in time? I mean, you can imagine an argument that says, look, it's cost-free to register compassion. What's the harm in stepping forward and expressing compassion for what's happening, and particularly with reference to the elderly and those that are unprotected? There's obviously, we have lost 1 million people. We have had a huge number of infections. We've suffered as a society. We have data. We have best practices. We have expertise of different kinds. The scientific and biomedical collaboration has not ended entirely. There's still NIH grants, almost 300. There's, collaborations of various forms that continue in this period. And perhaps there's a way in which non-governmental groups can be involved in some constructive way. You have philanthropies, you have non-governmental groups that deliver services. It just gets to this question. There seems to be so little happening at an official level from the West with regard to this, and little desire to take this up. And we know why. There's grave disincentives on both sides, right, to do this. What's your thoughts? Is there anything the West can offer that would be constructive?
You're absolutely right, right? When we talk about this official level, right, the potential cooperation between the two governments, that seems to be very forbidden, right? It's given the lack of trust, between the two countries. But that doesn't necessarily mean there's nothing we can do to show our compassion, show our goodwill, right, to China, to people in the country. So I do agree, right, the non-state actors, including the private sector, the NGOs could play a big role in support of China's anti-COVID efforts.
Would you include in that university-based researchers?
Yeah, university-based, but of course, but then the government here needs to create some space for them, right? The incentive for them, right, to cooperate, with China, right? And for the private sector, I think, indeed, given, for example, China's concern about, that this huge number of elderly people who are not vaccinated, right? We could, right, basically donate, right, the antiviral pills, or even share the technology with the Chinese manufacturers in producing those effective antiviral pills or even vaccines, right? That I think it's also, right, a projection of our soft power in China, which is, of course, being seriously undermined.
Now, when we're talking about sharing technology, that's not something that the U.S. government owns, right?
But remember, right, even in that forbidden atmosphere in 1989, right, the Merck, right, took the initiative of cutting a break-even deal, transferring the technology to mass manufacture the hepatitis B vaccines that saves millions of people in the country, that right. Even today, the Chinese people still remember that.
Yeah. So there is a powerful historical precedent.
Absolutely.
Have any of the leaders of Pfizer or Moderna or any of the other major magazine manufacturers expressed anything about this? Do you know?
Not to my knowledge. Yes.
I heard a report that the Chinese may have actually taken delivery of some volume of mRNA vaccines, either Pfizer or Moderna. Have you heard anything along those lines?
Well, they have ordered 100 million, right, BioNTech's mRNA vaccines, and some say that the vaccines already are in China, right, but that it's waiting for the approval of the Chinese government.
They have ordered these. This is outside of the BioNTech Fosun deal.
No, that's in that Fosun deal. It's 100 million doses.
If that deal gets approved, then you would see 100 million. Or do you think that 100 million have been delivered?
I assume it has been delivered, but that has not been confirmed, you know, from Fosun. You know.
So they do have the capacity, if this is true.
Yeah, they're building factories also, the manufacturing lines in Fosun, right, to mass produce these vaccines.
So they could eventually, it's just a matter of swallowing national pride. Is that what's the, it's a political barrier to this deal, right?
Well, essentially, the barrier is this political, right? That is the, well, I don't know whether it's called it's political, you know, simply because the national regulatory agencies, right, that they prefer, but the use of the, it seems that they prefer to approve the domestic vaccine first, you know, before approving, or if they will approve the BioNTech's vaccine.
So, last question. How do we estimate the impact that this crisis is having on public opinion inside China? I mean, we know that a very, very large portion of Shanghai citizens are quite alienated and quite angry.
Yeah, there's a relatively considerable portion of the population who feel alienated, you know, who feel unhappy with the government mishandling of the crisis. But in the meantime, I think the overall support of that policy continue to be there. Doesn't necessarily mean, right, all these people in Shanghai are against the zero COVID policy, right? So when you are dealing with like an ineffective policy, but I think the people's response actually varied. You know, there's certainly also whether it's the exit option for the people, you know, that there seems to be some anecdotal evidence suggesting that those who are considering emigrating, leaving China, have increased significantly. There's also by certain people who, you know, voice their concerns, their dissatisfaction on, you know, the government mishandling of the crisis. Some even, started to voice, you know, vent their anger on the policy itself. But still, we, you know, should not forget there's still a large percent of the population who continue to support the zero COVID policy.
So far, I mean, what I hear you saying is, yes, this is not helped Xi's popularity, but it has not destabilized.
No, not yet. I think overall, I think nationwide, especially in those smaller cities, you know, and the countryside, where, you know, the people have only limited access to alternative information, people are still buying to the theory on the necessity of sustaining zero COVID, you know, how dangerous, you know, Omicron variant is, you know, how terrible the situation is in countries like the United States. So, you know, that all help, right, to sustain the certain legitimacy of the policy, at least in the foreseeable future.
Okay, one last quick question, which is, where do you find hope in this situation?
Well, within Chinese, some like to say, right, the crisis also means opportunities, right? I just hope, right, that this crisis also could teach a lesson, you know, to policymakers to improve their crisis management in the future. In the meantime, you know, also may enable, right, the Chinese people, right, to organize themselves to be more open-minded, you know, to be more willing to tolerate different opinions, you know, that because many people only learn about, right, that is the how, you know, the unproductive the policy is until their beloved ones, right, become victimized of the policy. But, you know, overall, I don't think this world crises will have any long-term sustained effect, you know, on the way the politics is conducted in China.
Yunzong, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been a terrific conversation.
Thank you, Steve.
Coronavirus Crisis Update is produced by Liz Pulver. You can find our full catalog of podcasts, including Pandemic Planet and AIDS Existential Moment, on our homepage at csis.org/podcasts.